Good evening and welcome to Starseed Radio. I'm Arielle, and tonight it's my privilege to have with us a woman with whom I know millions of people have had indirect contact without knowing it. The reason I say this is because she has been teacher, guide, and mentor to many famous people. And through their work, you have had contact indirectly with our guest. It was her requirement that she remain anonymous and not be mentioned in their works. She's an author of two books herself, both of which can be found at starseedhotline.com, Quartz Crystals, A Celestial Point of View, and 50 Questions and Answers. Now, she doesn't claim to have authored these books because she actually channeled them. She's the one who coined the phrase Pleiadian lineup and the actual word starseed. We'll get into that in another interview. The next Pleiadian lineup starts November 16th, 2009, at about 12 Eastern Time, and will last through the 19th of November. And we are going to hear more about that. Tonight, it's my great honor to present to you Lavendar.
This is Lavendar, and I have had a lot of experience with Pleiadian lineup, which is November. Actually, it starts the 15th through the 20th of November, and then also May the 15th through the 20th. Sometimes it starts on the 16th of both months. So because of the experience that I've had over 25 years of tracking this, I find that I give it some leeway. And what Pleiadian lineup is the Pleiades aligns with the Earth in such a way as to offer a window of opportunity for Pleiadian spaceships to come to Earth, and they'll stay for two or three days and actually monitor the children on the planet, all children, whether they're old or young, makes no difference to them because they have their Pleiadian experiments through bloodlines on the planet, and they check on them every 6 months. So is there anything in particular that you'd like to ask me more about Pleiadian lineup?
Is this a time when we can initiate communication?
Yes, it is. If you're open and receiving, if you're ascending and receiving station for the Pleiadians, this will be at the time when communication will really be more profound than any other time, because it seems to be a time when the fullness of their communication happens.
And can this communication happen if you are not aware of Pleiadians or Pleiadian lineup, or if you're a star child?
Yes.
Can things happen anyway?
Yes, it can happen anyway. It's like, you know, understanding is not a prerequisite for a happening. And a person can be, say, out in nature, and all kinds of beautiful nature spirits or some kind of communication will start happening. And maybe this will be the awakening for the Pleiadian person on the planet. And maybe it comes because it's at these particular times. So a person doesn't have to be aware. It can happen anyway.
And what about dreams at this time?
I would say that dreams might be a little more accelerated, having to do with a person's mission on the planet, their starseeds activated in a stronger way. Maybe they'll have dreams of other lifetimes that they've had with the Pleiadians, or having to do something with codes or colors, something having to activate their spirit into being.
Would you tell us about your, just prior to your trip to Cairo, Egypt in 1983?
Well, I actually left on November 9th. I went to Greece first, and then on to Cairo. And there was a group of people that were with us on this trip. I put the word out to several people that there was going to be an activation from the Pleiades directly inside the Great Pyramid of Giza. And whoever wanted to join me could, and several people did show up. I think there was about 18 people that showed up for this trip. And they all were from different walks of life, and they all came and witnessed this from different perspectives. And the first night that it happened, a lot of us were just put to sleep for a couple of hours. We had 2 hours of missing time. And at this particular time, I was given some mantras to say as people would lay down in the sarcophagus. There was a ceremony that I would perform, and somehow it would resonate in their soul and in their blood crystals, and that would depend on the experiment that was at hand. And I got to witness a lot of walk-in energies that happened with people that went into to the sarcophagus. And on this Pleiadian lineup, we were told that this experiment would go on for the rest of our stay on the planet, and that a lot of us wouldn't even have contact with each other once we walked out of the pyramid. And of course, many, many years later now, I can actually say that's very, very true. I probably only have contact with maybe one or two others that were there, and the rest I have not heard from. However, recently, in the same week, I had two people call me a couple of weeks ago that had tracked me down to ask me, you know, how I was doing and what's been happening since our time in Cairo, Egypt.
Let's back up a bit and tell me how you got the call that you were supposed to do this.
I was living in Colorado, in Cripple Creek, Colorado, in an A-frame house that was sitting on a quartz crystal gold frequency bed. And for somehow this place became a stargate. And it was where beings would come and go from. And it was also the place where Nikola Tesla had caught lightning in a jar, the property that I was on. And people would come to the house and knock on the door and say, "Can I walk on your property?" And I'd say, "Well, what for?" And they'd say, "Well, this is where Tesla caught lightning in a jar." And I said, "Who's Tesla?" Well, that was in 1980. And more and more of these inventors would show up and walk on the property. And as this started happening, simultaneously, I started being contacted, telling me that there was going to be some experiments placed on the planet, and one of them was a Pleiadian experiment. And I asked if I was Pleiadian, and they said, "No, but you're loaned to Pleiadians to do certain kinds of work because of your genetic makeup." And it took me some time to really understand what that meant, you know, but after a while, I became very comfortable with it. In my house, like I said, there was a stargate, and I would go through periods of time where I'd go missing, and then I'd come back, and I would sit down, and I would write. And I had a lot of different high strangeness happen from this house. But one of the things that was imprinted on me to know about was that gigantic experiment that was going to be happening on November 17th, 18th, and 19th, in Cairo, Egypt, which actually started there on the 16th. But and I was to put the call out, and whoever wanted to show up would show up, and they would be monitored day and night the rest of their stay on the planet. When I say monitored, I must say that they would be given crystalline implants, and these would be implants that would be placed in their bodies. And I don't think there's any way that those implants can be taken out. Those are regulated by the Pleiadians. And once you put your hand up for this kind of assignment or this kind of experiment, it's very hard to opt out of it.
Were you told that you were to be there to officiate this initiation?
Yes, I was told that I would take these two hand crystals that had been given to me, and that I was to, there were mantras, there were sounds that I was to make, and there was a particular kind of resonant tone that I prepared my body for one full month. I did these sounds for a period of time every day, preparing my physical body to hold the kind of energies that I was going to have to hold when doing these particular experiments. And when I look back on it now, I'm really glad that I did this extended practice time, because when the Pleiadians came and actually hooked me up to this frequency, if I had not prepared my body frequency-wise, I could have died. In fact, I think I came very close to dying because the intensity was so strong. You know, when you blend another kind of consciousness with another consciousness, you know, it's like trying to put a plug into a 120 into a 220. It doesn't work. So I had to practice being a 220 for a month just so I could hold the resonant tone. It's very hard to describe what it was that I really went through. But since I had a double pineal, and that was part of the requirement for me doing this work, was that I actually had like an extra set of consciousness in my body that was able to hold this.
How do you know that you have a double pineal?
When I was the Los Angeles area back in 1974, I was having headaches, and I went to see a doctor, and they took a picture of my head and said I had a tumor and that they wanted to remove it. And at that time, I was living in the Hollywood Hills with this channel named, the channel's name was Frenette, and she told me, she says, do not let them operate because you have a double pineal. So I got the x-ray, or whatever you want to call it, showing where this was, and of course it was sitting right on my pineal, and there was two of them, and I could see that, and I did not let them operate. And because of this double pineal, for many years after that, this is how I was communicated with. They would come and go the other side of me through this double pineal. In other words, when I would channel information, I would still be present. I didn't have to, you know, drop out or go into a trance and allow them to come and use my body, because I was always conscious the entire time that they would come.
As we know, the pineal is called the seat of the soul, or the third eye. So in effect, you kind of have a Siamese twin type soul,
right,
location in your brain.
Right.
Okay. Now,
there's others like me on the planet, and when they designed me, and I say they designed me because I was genetically engineered, there's 11 others that were designed at the same time as me. I have not met any of them, but they say at some point in time that there is a good chance that they will arrange the meeting for all of us to come together at some point.
So, okay, you were told through this communication system that you were to go to Cairo. You prepared yourself physically, and you went to Cairo. Tell us about the little crystals.
Yes, before I left on this trip, I was told to secure a group of tiny, tiny quartz crystals that could only be found in a place called the Jeffries Mine in Arkansas. And when I researched the Jeffries Mine, I found that it was underwater. Therefore, I had to hire divers to go down and get these tiny, tiny crystals. And they were very, very tiny, but they were double-terminated and open on both ends. They're solution quartz crystals, meaning that they grow in the water. And also, there has to be some gold frequency for them to be able to grow, which was another attribute of these little crystals. So I secured about 40 pounds of them, and had several people to hand deliver them, but there was one interesting thing that happened. By the time I got to New York, and as they were being relayed to me, I found out that the person that had them in Dallas had actually taken half of them out to take them to Ruidoso to be charged and left me with a lot of trash crystals. So I had to call my friend Belva Bloomer, and I asked her to, you know, drop what she was doing, jump on an airplane, and she and her friend Carol, they went and secured another batch of crystals, and they showed up in Cairo, Egypt, about 2 hours before I was ready to go inside the pyramid. And at that time, it was it was a thrill a minute waiting for those crystals to show up, because I knew that they had an assignment for these crystals. And these crystals, later I named them the Giza crystals, they were taken into the Queen's Chamber, activated for 2 days and two nights, and they were brought back to me, and I asked the Pleiadians, I said, you know, what should I do with these? And they said, well, you have crystal workers, and they're the balancing beam between nature and man. And you can plant them at the base of trees, around mountains, in Devic kingdoms. They can be healing devices if someone is critical. If there's a life and death situation, you have permission to pop them in your mouth and take it and swallow it with water. And so I was just, asking a lot of questions about these crystals. And finally they said, look, you have nothing on your planet to measure these crystals with, because they're 7 million times celestial power, and you have nothing to measure it with. And with that, I just kind of stopped asking questions at that time. Later on, in a couple of days after the initiation, the mayor of Giza came to my hotel room and wanted one of the crystals. And I said, sure, and I handed him one. And he popped it in his mouth and chased it with scotch. And I just stood there in horror. I said, why did you do that? He said, because I'm going to be operated on tomorrow for a very serious operation, and they tell me that I may not make it. So the next day when he was operated on, they said that a blue light came into the room, and there was a strong healing that took place, and his operation was very successful. And of course, everyone was talking about it at this point, because he was the mayor of Giza. He was also the nephew of President Mubarak, and it caused quite a stir. And I was very lucky just to go to the airport and fly out of there, because all of a sudden people wanted these crystals.
So how did was it difficult for you to get private access to the pyramid to do this work?
No. Well, yes and no. There was a man, his name was Mahmoud Mubarak, and he had been keeper of the keys of the Great Pyramid for about 35 years, and he had a huge family that he took care of. And I had had an experience with him back in 81, where he experienced something with me that made him realized that something was connected to me that he was to pay attention to. And what happened was, we were down at outside the Mina house at a little cafe, and I turned to him and I said, you know, when was the last time it rained here in Cairo? He said, oh, it's been many, many months. And I said, well, it's going to rain today. He said, how could it? There's not a cloud in the sky. No, it will not rain. No, it doesn't rain in March. This was in March. And so, all of a sudden, within about 5 minutes, it started raining, and there wasn't not one cloud in the sky. And it rained over about a 4 to 5 block area. And the man that I was with at that time walked up to me with water all over his glasses and said, oh, what have you done? And I said, I haven't done anything. And all of a sudden, Mahmoud just fell to the ground, and he said, oh, you've returned as you've promised. He said, you must come back here in November. when the Venus star arrives, that's what he called the Pleiadians, the Venus star. And I didn't know what he was talking about. Then the next thought he had was, he said, "You've got to come with me right away." And he just jerked me up and literally dragged me up to the pyramid and grabbed a candle, not a flashlight, a candle, and we went straight down into the subterranean chamber. And that's where I had 2 hours of missing time. And then when I came out of there, I was very angry. I was very upset. And when I looked at the Egyptian men, I didn't like the way they were looking at me, and I didn't like what they were thinking, and I just had to hurry and get to my hotel room. And then I had a very strong feeling that I could not leave the pyramid. And yet all of us were supposed to get on a train and go to Luxor, and I didn't want to go. And in fact, I threw such a fit that they bodily had to put me on the train to go. Well, in a couple of days, President Reagan was shot. And I went back to Cairo, and I asked Mahmoud if we could go inside the pyramid, and he said yes. And so a great deal of work happened from the pyramids through the act of Bardo, because we were told that Brady had died. In actuality, he was on the operating table, and there was a miracle that happened to Brady at that time, which was the press secretary. And, of course, Reagan, he got a walk-in at that time. And I didn't really know too much about walk-ins then, but later I became to know that a walk-in came to spend the rest of his stay as President of the United States. And that's how I came to know Mahmoud, who got us inside the pyramid in 83, because in 81 I had been there, and he had experienced this raining episode, which I had nothing to do with. I didn't even know it was going to happen. But that's the way ET experiments are put in motion. They do things, and then you're standing there with egg on your face wondering, well, why did that happen? I was just as surprised as anyone else.
So the crystals show up 2 hours before you were due to take your group inside of the pyramid.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about the reason, the process, and the people's transformations.
Well, the people that had decided to show up for it, and if some of them, people that had raised their hand to come, at some level had really inside their souls, they were ready to have this happen, or they wouldn't have been there. In other words, there were two people that came out of curiosity, but once you walk through the veil of walking in there, curiosity can no longer play. You are going to get a crystalline implant, and they are going to monitor you for the rest of the stay on your planet. And although you're told this, and you may, you know, have this blank look on your face like, well, what does that mean? Well, you shouldn't have walked through the veil. And curiosity, you know, gets a lot of people into some of these ET experiments when they don't have a clue of what they're doing.
And was there Pleiadian souls, energies that came and traded places with these people?
Yes, I got to see a, there was a gentleman from Dallas. I won't mention anyone's name about this trip because I don't have their permission to do so, but there was a gentleman from Dallas, and it was 4 o'clock in the morning, and one of the ladies that came with us to be on the trip, the time had been changed to go inside the pyramid, and therefore she was locked out. So she got to witness it on the outside. She was camped outside the pyramid with some Egyptian women. And they said at 4 o'clock in the morning, when this particular person was laying in the sarcophagus, that they saw these thousands of tiny little white starlights that came from the top of the pyramid and went up into this ship that was above the pyramid. They got to witness the ship. They got to witness the transfer of this soul. And then they said, once the silver lights went up into the ship, then the next thing that happened, the gold lights came down from the ship, and I guess that's when they brought in a new walk-in. And what happened at 4 a.m. that time in Dallas, Texas, his ex-wife died at that very moment. And so two of them left at the same time. A walk-in came, though, to take care of their children and to, you know, and put the experiment further into alignment with what was taking place that night. That was a very, very strong demonstration of a walk-in. Another walk-in that happened just prior to that, by about an hour, was there was this guy from Las Vegas who had at the last minute shown up, and he had a girlfriend with him. And before that time, he had been kind of billing cooing with one of the other girls, a Jewish girl on the trip. And they had just fallen madly in love for about 2 hours before we went inside the pyramid. Well, when he laid down in the sarcophagus, he actually died. And all of a sudden, I'm thinking, oh my God. You know, we signed a piece of paper promising that no one would die, and look, someone's died. What am I going to do? Then all of a sudden, this went on for about 6 minutes, he was dead. Someone jumped in and said he's not breathing, and we had, you know, a rescue remedy, we had crystals, we had magnets, we were doing everything. Then all of a sudden, he took this big, deep breath, and his voice was kind of garbled, but he said, how come they gave me a body without any arms? And I was just stunned. I was just stunned, and so I turned to my friend and I said, rub his arms, rub his arms. So, you know, then we rubbed his arms. He gets up, steps out of the sarcophagus, and here's the little Jewish girl, you know, Bill and Cohen just couldn't wait for him to acknowledge her. He walked straight past her, didn't even know her, and walked out of the pyramid. And I am just, a part of me is going, oh my God. You know, and another part is saying, keep it steady, just get ready for the very next initiation. I said, okay. And those are the kind of things that I went through for 2 days and two nights inside that pyramid. Another thing happened was I kept drinking all this water, and I never peed. Never peed. It was amazing. I just drank tons and tons of water, and I don't know where it went. Just a little side note.
So, there are pictures of you officiating at this Pleiadian initiation on Pleiadian lineup in November of 1983, where you have your arms up in the air with these two hand crystals. And didn't you tell me at one time that you had your arms up in the air the whole time?
Yeah, most of the time. In between, as each person would come and lay in their sarcophagus, my arms went up, and I held my arms up, and it was about 45 minutes for each person. And there was 18 people the second night. The first night was a closed session with a celebrity that I will not name at this time, but there, that was another experiment of which I may or may not ever talk about. But the second night was really the profound night, because it was the night of demonstration of what walk-ins are about. It was a demonstration of how they come down and infuse this crystalline frequency to align a person to their mission, and to help them go forward with, you know, their records. It was an incredible experience for everyone. Although I didn't get to stay in contact with many of them after it was over, which I was told that I probably wouldn't. A part of me was very sad, but then at the same time, it's like, you know, if you become an experiment with the Pleiadians, You go on about your life, and you don't have to stay connected to the people that you experienced it with, because you're on your own mission and they're on their own mission.